Welcome to Off the Bench with Danny Cannell.
Back to throw, first and 10. Keeps his tight end.
And Rajah Bell.
Bell has done something. 22 to Rajah.
Saw the future of football right before your eyes. Just yell it out, man. He can't guard me.
What is going on? Welcome to Off the Bench with Danny Cannell and Rajah Bell. It is a Wednesday. We got Hannah and Debo joining us as always. Coming up, we got David Sampson, longtime president of the Florida Marlins. He's going to join us as well. Excuse me if I call him Florida Marlins. That's the way I was grew up, the way I was raised on it. I know it's Miami, but I'm old school, Hannah. That's how I roll. I roll old school like that.
All right.
But he's going to join us. We'll have some fun with him. And we're going to do a little MLB preview with him. I can't wait to hear Rajah's predictions for the MLB season as we dive deep into the AL East race. You ready, Rajah?
Dude, I've been doing my homework for like the last 3 days. I cannot wait for the segment.
The last 3 days. It was like 1 minute a day, though. That's
it. Fantastic. We're going to get to that a little bit later. But the NFL, I think, is starting to rival the NBA with off-season drama, because the NBA, I've always been kind of jealous about it, because you had so many moves with Kevin Durant's free agency. What was he going to do? And there was that watch a couple years ago. Then this past season, Russell Westbrook, what was he going to do? Was he going to stay in OKC? It always seems like there's some drama, and the NFL always seemed kind of boring. Like, there weren't many big deals, there weren't many big trades, but this season I think is the most entertaining NFL off-season we've seen in 10 years at least. With the amount of big trades, with the amount of like Alex Smith getting a big time franchise quarterback getting traded to Washington, with a big time free agent Kirk Cousins being, you know, hitting the market open, the draft is insane, and now you have potentially. Now I say potential because I don't know how real it is, but it does seem like there is a bigger move that the Giants want to make with one Odell Beckham Jr. The Giants have not done anything to silence the rumors because they've been talked about a lot, and they've just kind of floated it out there, said, well, you know, we're open, we'll listen, we're not going to turn down anybody. He's one of the most talented players in the league, not even wide receivers. He is one of the most talented players in the league. There is a contract dispute because he wants to get an extension. The Giants are looking back saying, hey, you've had your share of issues on the field, but also off the field, where he was caught in a Snapchat video with a girl that had some illicit drugs in it.
Bro, so, that was never confirmed.
True.
Ever.
He was, what, the drugs?
Did you see the video?
The drugs. The video was confirmed.
Did you see the video?
But it was never confirmed that there were drugs.
Did you see the video?
I did see the video.
All right. So what do you think?
Go ahead. That it wasn't Splenda.
Right.
Or some,
correct.
Or
baby powder.
Right. It could have been that lined up in neat lines while she was holding a credit card. But it could have been something else, too. So I think they should move him. I think he's been enough of a distraction that the Giants should move on from Odell Beckham. But there's a couple reasons why. One, because of the contract dispute. He said he not only wants to be the highest paid wide receiver, he wants to be the highest paid non-quarterback in the league, which is really lofty. I think if he said, I want to be the highest paid receiver, I'm cool with that. But he's been over the top. I think the distractions have gotten to a point where he's shown way too much immaturity. There's got to be a point in everybody's career where you grow up, where you kind of get it, where you say, all right, I need to stop. Like, I need to stop being an idiot, right? And Odell has not shown me that. And the last reason is because he's been hurt. Like, he missed the entire last season with injuries. He's a player that has, like, the fast twitch muscles, so there's always kind of been some hammy issues, groin issues, because that's just part of the deal. When you're blessed with that much God-given talent, you have issues sometimes with those. I think the Giants should move on if they can get a value for him. And I think there would be teams that would match up and say, yeah, sure, we'll give you a first-round pick and maybe something else. And if they can do that, I think it's a no-brainer.
Part of me doesn't want the Giants to keep him because then, like, I don't know. Oh, no, okay. I'm going to change my opinion. Mm-hmm. Part of me wants the Giants to keep him because then this story's totally over. Like, I want this to be put to rest. I'm over talking about him. I think this has, like, become the battle of the whiners.
Yes. I understand completely what you're saying and the sentiment. You do not trade Odell Beckham Jr. I don't care what first round pick. You're not getting Odell Beckham Jr. back in return. He is the best wide receiver in football. And Danny, I'm with you a little bit. Like, I've said it before too. Like, I don't love all of the immaturity issues and the stuff going on, you know, off the field, but I mean, I think they hit the nail on the head. Who was it? Gettleman that said it about the, you don't quit on talent?
Yep.
You don't quit on like real talent. You certainly don't quit on talent that you can't replace. And they can't. There's no replacing what that cat does. You're coming down to Eli Manning, like in the twilight of his career. It's his fifth year in the league. It's not like he's an 8-year vet. I mean, he's still a young pup. I understand where you're coming from. I would not quit on a talent like that. You might quit on some talent. You don't quit on that talent. Like, that talent is transcending talent. You don't quit on that.
I agree with you, but I also think the contract is an issue, because what if he's only there one more year and then he's going to bounce? Or what if he holds out? Because he said he's not going to train, and I don't care about.
Let me ask you a question, though. Let me ask you a question, not to cut you off, but who, like, if you're going to pay him the most out of any position other than quarterback, like, what other positions should be paid more than him? Like, what other people? You know, give me some names, because obviously I'm a basketball guy.
Miller or Aaron Donald. Aaron Donald is he's going to break the bank for the Rams. I mean, there's a reason he held out last year, because he's under his first contract. You know, he's under his first deal. He's trying to get paid. The concern for me with a guy like Odell Beckham is guaranteed money, because then you really have no leverage and disciplinary issues. Like, you can't really, you know, if he gets disgruntled, he's going to be able to say, well, I got 80 million guaranteed or 70 million guaranteed, whatever the number is that's guaranteed, where that would concern me, especially with a player like him who is not proven reliable. Like, if you're going to back up the boat, back up the truck and just say, all right, we're going to dump a bunch of money at your feet, you better trust that player is going to produce. Like, that's why I thought the Dolphins made a huge mistake with Sue, and why they ended up cutting him, is because when Ngannou Sue was paid, he quit. Like, he gave up on effort. He didn't care. And now it's interesting. I thought the Rams actually did a really good thing in signing him for 1 year, because then he's got to prove himself. I thought that was the genius deal. So that's what makes me nervous about Odell Beckham.
But that happens all the time with quarterbacks. It happens all the time. It just happened for three quarterbacks like this offseason, where they back up the truck, they give him a bunch of bread, and they haven't proven ish. Like, it happens.
But
they don't quit.
Like, and I would say that they're bad quarterbacks.
Odell Beckham Jr. quits. Like, I mean, he's got some issues, like, in terms of anger management on the field and being with Instagram models who have baby powder and stuff. I mean, but I don't think he quits. And Ndamukong Suh, I mean, I guess, you know, I would make the argument that if he weren't here last year, like, they would have been a markedly worse team than they were. I mean, I guess I'm saying I understand what you're saying, but I think it happens way more often in other positions, and it's not really viewed the same for one reason or another.
I think because receivers, like, there has never been a franchise that has been built around a wide receiver that's had a run. Like, I was trying to think of this, like, which team was built around a wide receiver that won a Super Bowl? And there really hasn't been. Like, there have been teams that have went around defenses with average quarterbacks. There's been teams won around great quarterbacks. There's been even running back, it's been a while, because the way the game has changed.
Have there been teams built around, like, quarterback receiver duos?
Oh yeah, for sure. But, like, those guys, like, the greatest receiver duo of all time, Joe Montana and Jerry Rice. Like, Jerry Rice was a team guy. Like, as good as he was a hard worker. Like, he was, with this relentless desire to win. I was going back to Michael Irvin, because I thought Michael Irvin was a guy that was pretty, you know, he was kind of a diva wide receiver, loved to talk, was competitive, none of it was publicized at the time, but, I mean, famously, the White House and Dallas, like, the problems, you know, the stuff that was going off the field. But he also had Troy Aikman and Emmitt Smith. So he had, you know, guys that were built around him. So it wasn't just a wide receiver. I just think it's a position that if you get, because I think he's the second best, because of Antonio Brown, I think, is the best. I think Odell is right there. But let's say he's going to give you 1,400 or 1,500 yards a season. I think you would trade it for a guy that can give you 1,100 yards or 1,000 yards, who's going to be more of a team guy, who's going to buy in, who's going to be reliable, who's going to be there and be more endurable. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that makes complete sense. And if he's not a team guy, and I don't equate what happens with him off the field as not being a team guy. Like, they're not hand in hand for me. Like, I think people can have a life outside of football and do things off the football field that don't necessarily creep into your on-field issues,
and look,
or your on-field,
like, nobody's there are no angels in the, like, I, like, guys party, right? Like, guys go out and, you know, they go out, they have fun.
Sure.
You know, guys can have their own career. Like, hey, he's made a ton of money off the field. Like, I have no problem with that. My issue is when he gets into it on the sideline with his own teammates, or when he gets, you know, so many, when he gets in the fight with Josh Norman a couple years ago, where he's so distracted, where he got multiple, you know, 15-yard penalties, where it actually ends up hurting the team. And even more when he was hurt. So he hurt his ankle and he had like the boot on and he was, you know, trying to come back supposedly. But then he was like spotted out in a club dancing like in a dance off while he's supposed to be in rehab. I think you have to be smarter than that if you want to be paid a lot of money. Like, that's a rookie or a second year guy mistake. Like, right, to me, if you're a veteran, if you're going to be a guy, you got to be trustworthy and a guy that's smart enough to say, you know what, if I'm hurt, maybe I should get back on the field and do everything I can to get back there. Does that make sense?
It does. But what I would say is he was a third or fourth year guy. Again, it's not like he's a 7-year guy. I understand where you're coming from. I just think, like, I'm just pushing back because he is young. I think when we view like a competitive spirit, sometimes like we view different positions. Like when a receiver does it, he's a diva and he's losing it. But like if Tom Brady or Russell Wilson goes out there and they're yelling at their OC or they're flipping or screaming at an official running off the field because they didn't get a call, it's just their competitive spirit. Like, I think it's viewed a little different. So I'm standing up for my wide receivers, even though I didn't play the position.
There you go. No doubt it'll be interesting to watch, see what plays out in the next 4 weeks is up to the draft. Whether he stays or whether he goes. All right, let's move up. One of our favorite segments. Let's do it, Debo.
Like it, love it, hate it.
Oh, the NFL, they're the most reactive league out of all of them. Like, the NBA, I think, is progressive. Like, they're forward-thinking, so they get in front of problems. The NFL reacts. Like, hey, oh, my gosh, what, you know, something happened, so let's change this. So there is a new catch rule that was unanimously approved after you saw multiple catches. The Jesse James catch for the Steelers against the Patriots. You had the Super Bowl. There were a couple catches that were controversial. Thankfully, for Debo's sake, they were called correctly, in my opinion.
Correctly. Correct.
You know, Zach Ertz's touchdown was called correctly. But the new rule has a new three-step process. One, the receiver must control the ball. Duh. Two, establish himself in bounds. Duh. And then three is the one that's kind of trying to clear things up. Perform a football move, such as taking a third step or lunging with the ball in hand. Noticeably missing from the new three-step process is controlling the ball through the ground. I think this is a good thing, but I think it will in no way straighten things up or clear things up through the process. I still think you're going to have controversial, quote, catches this year forever.
Love it, hate it.
Danny, I was going to ask you this because don't you think in order for this to work, it has to be super consistent? Like, they have to practice this all the time. And I feel like there's a slim chance that that happens.
Oh, you're 100% right. So I like it. I don't love it because I like the fact that they tried to figure it. But as far as what you're saying, like, there's still there, and they even admit it. They said there still is a gray area. Like, there's, for instance, there is supposed to be, like, what is a football move? Like, that's real, you know, vague. Like, who knows? Like, and
super
different
subjective.
Refs can do that differently. I think it's supposed to be three steps on the ground. Well, what if it's two steps and kind of a shuffle or a half step? Like, there's going to be times when I wish what they would have done is kind of handled the review process, because I think that's what messes it up in the first place, because they look at it so many times in super slow-mo. And you can nitpick everything. I think what they should have really emphasized is that the call on the field, and I know this is the rule, the call on the field, unless it's, evidence, you know, so obvious that you have to overturn it. But I wish they would have reemphasized that. Hey, the official's call is the one that's going to stand unless it's blatantly obvious that it wasn't a catch. Like, that's the way I think they could have solved it.
Yeah, I like it because there needed to be a little bit more clarity on the rule, and I didn't think the old one was clear enough, but I don't love it because it didn't clear it all the way up, and you just kind of spoke to that. It still leaves a whole lot of subjectivity, a whole lot of gray area with what one ref might think versus what another one might think. I agree with you. It needs to be a lot more difficult for them to overturn a call, and I think they should cap. I think they should cap the time that the referees have to make that decision. I think they should put like a 1-minute review. Like, if you can't make the decision within 1 minute, you got to keep the game moving. Let's not draw this out and turn it into a 5-minute thing. Just keep the pace of the game up and keep it moving.
Next up.
Like it, love it, hate it.
All right, there's a new penalty that's been instituted. The NFL, again, reactionary, trying to stay ahead of the CTE issue, concussions, player safety. So now they have instituted a new 15-yard penalty and possible ejection for lowering your head to make a hit. Now, you sound like, oh, okay, a guy's coming to make a tackle. But it is not only for tacklers. It is also for ball carriers, and it's even for linemen on both sides of the ball. I think this rule is dangerous. For a couple reasons. One, for physically for the players, because I think you're going to see an increase of guys going low, which means what? More ACL injuries as opposed to head-to-head collisions. I think it's dangerous because how is this going to be called? There is head-to-head contact on every single play in the NFL. And if you really called this by the letter of the law, you would have a four-hour game because of the amount of penalties that would be called. So I think this is really going to cause the NFL some problems next year when they start to implement it. Now, if there are some obvious situations where it's crown and the guy really lowers his head and it really leans forward, then I think it'll be a little bit easier to apply and administer. But I think this is gonna present some problems for the NFL this season. And the players are gonna hate it. Like as much fans are saying, hey, player safety, the players are gonna hate this rule.
I hate it.
I hate it. I don't know if, like, as much as the NFL is trying to protect themselves, I don't really buy that they're doing it, right? So, like, not that I totally, like, understand the difference in this, like, hit because I haven't been out there to experience it. But I don't buy that it would make things better.
Yeah. First of all, I think Danny hit it. Almost every collision, there's somebody right. with a head. Like, yeah. You know, when my sons play, and my son's running the ball from the quarterback position, and he's running out of bounds, and someone comes to hit him. Like, when you go to brace yourself, you naturally, like, kind of, you know, tense up. There's collision there. And there's someone's helmet generally involved. Like, when you have two players both trying to go low, you don't think they're going to wind up cracking helmets? Like, what do you – you think you've solved the rule? You've almost made it, like, more prevalent with that you're going to have head-to-head contact with people both trying to get low enough to stay out of the way. I don't know how you enforce this. I don't know what it does to people who you've conditioned to play a certain way and their livelihood. Like, I'm with you, Danny. I don't think there's any place in the game for launching with the crown of your helmet and trying to maim people. Like, I think that needs to be cleaned up. I like the fact that the NFL is taking steps to kind of address, you know, the black eye that they've got recently with the concussions and the CTE and so on and so forth. I don't know that this rule, the way it's written, and it remains to be seen the way they kind of legislate the rule, the way they play it out. Like, I don't think that this solves your problem at all. I think it creates more problems. And I say this when I'm dealing with my kids in youth leagues, and they're trying to protect these kids, and they put in these rules about kids can only stay within the 3-point line. We don't want them coming out and defending. And I'm like, look, I get it. But you're just creating more problems because now you're going to have teams that are winning by 2 points just hold the ball outside the 3-point line. Like, you can't overthink some of these things. You've got to let the game be played, and it usually figures itself out. I don't think they got it right on this one.
I think the NFL is in big trouble, like, longer term. Like, I think that it's going to be a fraction of what we see now, the product. Like, I think in 20 years it's reasonable to think the NFL is kind of coming to a place of extinction, like where the sport is kind of dying. And I think it definitely is going to look, if it does survive, I think it's going to look completely different. And I think this is one of the first steps. But if you really, like, if you want to avoid head-to-head, like, take off the face masks or take off the helmets or change the helmets completely.
Right.
But people will go nuts for that, so they try to do these rules. So it's going to be interesting to see how this impacts the league. All right, next up, one of my
like
favorites.
Love it, hate it.
Yeah, Mike Tomlin. Doesn't like celebrating.
Beat it.
Even though the Steelers, they were one of the most popular ones in the league with, you know, Juju Smith-Schuster doing the bike chain around the thing when he lost his bike. They were doing the most collaborative efforts. He said, quote, it's a game for, it's for the entertainment of the fans, so I respect it on that level. But personally, I don't like it. I just think it takes away from the game. It's not a good look for young people. Young people aren't allowed to celebrate that way during games, so why should we? I love it. My man is on my page. You know how we talked about this in the season? I thought the celebrations were a little bit too much. I got like a little bit of celebration. Like, I like good old like high fives, go nuts, a good spike. But the dance routines, I'm over them.
Can I hit it, Raja?
Bro, please hit what?
Hate it.
Like, that's ridiculous. And first of all, where, like
can you
come out of the locker room at like at whatever country club you're playing golf at right now, talking about
yes.
high fives and
amen.
Like, take your khakis off, bro.
Yes.
What are you talking about?
Raja, you and I are on the same page today because I feel like as a fan and only a fan, I like to see the celebrations. Sometimes that's what makes me want to root for my team more is when they celebrate. I don't want to see a high five.
High five.
That's boring.
Who's this guy?
I want to see a well choreographed celebration. Always.
Okay, so I'm in the middle. I take it. I gotta be honest. Yeah, I don't love the over choreography. Like I like celebrations. I'm like a little more than high fives. Like I guess I'm a little more liberal than the high five, but I'm a little more conservative than the choreography. Like I'm right in the middle of that. I don't have a problem with dudes like doing a quick little dance or something like that. I don't really have a beef. I don't like when the whole team gets together and they do like, you know, the electric slide and they do
I don't know why I love that.
No, that's cool. But I also think that kids, like my son scored touchdowns. Like they've worked all week in practice to try to get a touchdown. Like, why can't he get in the end zone and do anything that's
not
like.
You know where I'm about dancing?
What?
At the club after, when you've got your table set up and VIP and you're celebrating a win. Like, that's the time.
Danny, what time do you leave the club when you do that, though?
11:50.
11:50.
Stop it. It was at least 12:15. Oh, it was at least 12:15.
That's fine. That's what I'm getting out of my Uber.
Though. I would go out after a game. You go celebrate with your boys. You're going to go out. That's when you celebrate. Not then. All right. Let's we can agree to disagree on that one. All right, we got a brand new segment here that Debo has rolled out. It's called Reasonable Expectations, because we have some guys, and I think it's reasonable to ask how we should look at them moving forward this season. So Markelle Fultz, we've talked a lot about him on this one as we've looked at him in pain and agony as we tried to watch his jump shot, which was one of the ugliest things you've ever seen. But I also think you've seen one of the greatest turnarounds, because he comes in, he plays the other night for the Sixers, and he looked outstanding. Like, Philly was loving it. He had 10 points, 8 assists, 4 rebounds. All right, so what are reasonable expectations? What do you got?
No, I didn't mean to cut you. He was not awesome. He was not. And Danny and I debated.
Didn't he set some record for like the amount of production in only 14 minutes?
Yes.
Like
Debo and I debated this. Look, he looked good on the court. I'm not going to take that away from him. He looked good. His ability to play make for himself, get other people involved. Like, the jump shot's going to be a work in progress, but he's clearly like a really, really good player. And I'm glad to see him back. What I didn't like about it was what happened after the game. And I don't know, like maybe it's me reading into it, but it spoke to where he is mentally about what was going on with that shot, and I think there's something deeper there. I've said it before. I think there's something mental there. The fact that when reporters asked him about the shoulder injury, which I think is a very fair question, like you've missed like all but what, 3 games this year? This was his third game played on the season?
Fifth
game played on the season? You were the number one pick in the draft? It's as fair a question as you can come about in a post-game press conference where you scored 10 points, 8 assists, you know, and so on and so forth. And you just completely like shut down and don't open your mouth multiple times when that question is posed to you. Like it bothered me, number one. And number two, it made me think that there is really something there mentally and emotionally. And that's a scary prospect for me, and it should be for Sixers fans and management.
I agree with you. I think there could be something there, because anytime you see – and I think the mental aspect, it looks like – and what we saw on video, like from the rehab process, and when he was so awful even at the free throw line, that it was sort of a mental hang-up, and you wonder what's there, if there's greater issues, like if there is some issue that's there. But I do think this is a huge bonus – for the Sixers, like the season they're having, sitting in the fourth seed right now with the young talent that they had. I don't think anybody was counting on anything from Markelle Fultz, even at the point of, and I think we even talked about it, like wondering, would he be a bust? Would he ever be able to return? The fact that you're able to get something out of them, I think is huge for the Sixers. I think in the playoffs too, I think they're going to be a fun team to watch because they're so new to this. They're almost naive. Like they don't know any better, like what they're supposed to do. So I think they could have some fun in the playoffs. Like, I'm not saying they're going to win the Eastern Conference or they're going to beat LeBron, but I think they're going to win a round. Don't you? Like, don't you think that's reasonable to think they could advance through a round of the playoffs?
I think it's reasonable. I don't know that they will. I don't know that they'll beat Indiana. I don't know that – I mean, Victor Oladipo and them are playing great. But I agree with you. Having him back – look, I want to be frank. For the kid, for the city of Philly, for the organization. I think it's fantastic. And I hope that I am wrong. I hope that there's not something bigger there. So reasonably, yes, you could say that they'd win a playoff series. I agree with you. I don't think they would win the East this year. But from where they sat a year or two ago to where they are now, I mean, you can't be anything but like super excited about the direction of the franchise. And if all of these guys are healthy physically and mentally, I mean, the future is really bright in Philly. And you'll have a buttload of cash potentially this summer to go out and try to entice somebody else to join that young nucleus.
All right, let's go to the Warriors, because for what is a reasonable expectation? Now, this is Steve Kerr's fault because he brought it on himself, because Steph Curry, we learned he's going to be out probably for the first round, maybe even more. Who knows the seriousness of this injury? But Steve Kerr went out there and said, you know what? It doesn't even matter. We can beat anyone without Steph Curry. Is that a reasonable expectation for this team?
Nope. I mean,
I'm with you. I think he set himself up for – I think that was not a very smart statement for a coach who usually handles things better.
Right. I obviously you should feel like that. I mean, any pro team should feel like, you know, the guys that are there are fully capable, whether you're missing your number one guy or not. Like when Amari Stoudemire went down for our like 0-06 Suns team, that sucked. But we really felt like we were still good enough to get it done when push came to shove. And so you have to feel like that. It's the reason. You know, one of the reasons you are where you are, that supreme confidence. But I'm going to be frank. They are not beating Houston without Steph Curry. That's not happening. Like, it could be a knockdown, drag-out series. It could be some really fun basketball. I'm sure Kevin Durant will go absolutely banana cakes. Like, there's some stuff that could be really fun to watch. But they are not beating Houston without Steph Curry. And if I'm not mistaken, second round right now, 4-5 series would be New Orleans and is it Oklahoma City? Same. You better watch out in that series without Steph Curry.
Well, they would play the Blazers right now.
They play the Blazers?
Three seed.
They play the three. Oh, they're two. My bad. I'm tripping. I'm thinking Houston. Yeah, they're the two seed. Yeah. But, yeah, you better watch out in the Blazers series without Steph Curry. But definitely not being Houston.
Quick question. Are they a better team? Could they – like, are they – like, if you lost Steph for the season or you lost Kevin Durant for the season, which is the better team?
See, it's easy for me to say if you lost Kevin Durant, but that team, they lost a lot of the pieces.
Yeah, I'm the other side. I think Steph Curry has almost been under – valued the last year and a half. Like, I think people forgot about what a dynamic shot maker he is and the impact he has extending the floor. I think people have completely overlooked him.
Yeah, no, I was going to say it's going to be easy for me to say that they're better with Steph because they won the championship, but I could definitely make the argument with you that they're better with KD because the team isn't built the same way that it was around Steph when they won those championships early. They've tinkered with some of those pieces around the edges, and so the complexion of the team's changed. That's a tough one, but I look, Kevin Durant, you're going with Steph Curry, right? I could easily say Steph, but I'm going to take KD, and I'm going to take the opposite side, fade you as usual, because I think he's bigger. It makes you a better defensive team when you've got that type of length on the court. And in a playoff game where Steph, I think the Cavs showed you the second time around the block that if he didn't have enough weaponry around him when Draymond was out, they would just crowd him. They would trap him. They would get the ball out of his hands. He was a little too small to counter that kind of stuff. You're not doing that with KD.
Here's what's happening with Hannah.
Two college coaching hires at programs that enjoyed success not too long ago, but now struggling. Pitt brings in Duke assistant Jeff Capel as its next head coach, while Louisville hires away Xavier's Chris Mack. Capel has been a Blue Devils assistant for the past seven seasons and is responsible for the nation's top recruiting class in four of its past 5 years. Mack had been in charge of the Musketeers since 2009, reaching the tourney eight times this season as a number one seed. His deal with the Cardinals is reportedly for 7 years at $4 million per.
Apparently nobody wanted the Pitt job, and that's how Jeff Capel's able to get a seven-year deal. But good for him for getting it. And then the Chris Mack to Louisville, he's had an incredible run at Xavier. I think it'll be interesting to see how the Louisville fans react to him, because I don't feel like he's a name that Louisville really goes nuts for. And this is a program that views themselves as a top three program in college basketball. I think they would have loved to seen a splashy hire like a Billy Donovan or, you know, somebody coming from the NBA. And I'll be interested to see how that plays out after they've had a lot to go through.
So other outlets will fall for fake news, but Off the Bench will not. We're going to play a little game of true or false. So true that LiAngelo Ball declared for the NBA draft yesterday.
True.
True that he scored 72 points in a game. But false that it's even worth talking about because there has never been more of a misleading stat line. Ball's Lithuanian squad played middle schoolers, and LeVar, a.k.a. Kris Jenner, rigged it to get his kid in the headlines. Guess it kind of worked. Oh, and
really,
true.
It's verified he played middle schoolers. This is real news.
Yes.
There's no one fact-checking Lithuanian players, so yes.
Did not play what? No damn middle school basketball players, man.
The kids were like 110 pounds, yeah.
That's
a shame.
Do you think so? He declares for the draft. Do you think he gets drafted in the first round?
No.
No. I was going to say true that Jello will not get drafted.
Wait, which one's Jello?
Jello.
Jello's the football player?
The one that was at UCLA.
One?
Yeah. I don't
the
know.
Middle
he's
one.
Not, he's not
the
even a good
brother.
One, right? It's the young Melo.
No, he will not get drafted.
Yeah. Is he going to play for the Lakers at all, Raja?
I mean, they might. I don't know. I don't think the Lakers would touch that. He'll probably wind up somewhere as a free agent, going to summer league with somebody. And look, if
he ends up with the Lakers, then LeVar Ball is more impressive than Kris Jenner and what she's done with the Kardashians.
Or he's got something on Magic.
If he pulls that off,
honestly,
he's already
no
called
one's
it.
More impressive than Kris Jenner. all right, Johnny Football throwing footballs at Texas A&M Pro Day, and the former Heisman Trophy winner and NFL flameout Manziel reportedly met with the Patriots multiple times.
What?
He's been linked with them a lot. Like even back to his last time around, he went to a game and he always talks about Brady being the GOAT. Patriots are always looking for value. I think it'd be a good spot for him if he gets that opportunity. He's going to make a minimum contract. He's just going to be a camp arm. And it's sort of, I mean, they took a shot with Tebow, who was, you know, a big distraction because all the stuff that he brought along with him, cameras, you know, conversation. And if the tightness of their routine and how tight a ship they run with not letting their players do anything or kind of, you know, have any fun, so to speak, I think with his issues that he's talked about, I think it might be a good option for him. I'm not saying he makes the team. I'm not saying he plays with them for a long time. But I think if you were looking at Manziel, I think this would be a huge home run to even have that opportunity to be a camp arm with the Patriots.
Two words, bro. Colin Kaepernick.
Ooh.
That's it. I think this is the difference. Manziel is desperate to play football. He'll do anything. He'll sign a split contract, which is basically saying, I'll sign, you know,
because he's got no resume, bro.
You're right. But Kaepernick will not sign for minimum. Like, he's saying, you got to pay me starter money or at least really high backup money. And I think that's part of the problem, too. Now, does he deserve that? Yes, he does. But that's the problem. I think he's the demand, like the salary hasn't met the offer.
That ain't
Colin
the problem,
Kaepernick.
Bro.
All right, moving on, guys. Damian Lillard with the individual performance of the night, dropping 41, 9, and 6 in the Blazers' crucial 107-103 victory over the Pelicans, keeping distance from teams like New Orleans challenging for the 3 seed. Elsewhere, the Heat blow out the Cavs 98-79. I love that one. Cleveland without Kevin Love in the second half due to what was initially diagnosed as a loose tooth, which turned into concussion-like symptoms.
Kevin Love. Jesus. He's like Mr. Glass.
Can we talk about that Heat Cavs?
I love Kevin. I love Kevin. Kevin's my dude. Like, I feel so bad for Kevin sometimes when I watch the games because he cannot stop getting hurt. But it's all right. They'll be fine. They got bigger issues. Kevin Love's teeth. They'll fix those. Damian Lillard is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. He's like a video game. He might be my new favorite player in the NBA just to watch him get buckets because it's really fun to watch. But Kev, they need to just wrap him in like pre-wrap,
bubble wrap,
like, put some like casting agent on the outside and let him play like that.
All right, last.
I had the same exact. As soon as he went down and he stood and he was on the ground for a couple minutes, and you kind of saw, I was like, he's done. He's not coming back in the game.
And it's never fake. It's not like it's fake stuff. Like, he genuinely gets jacked up every time he touches the court.
All right, lastly, guys.
Injury prone.
Dirk Nowitzki will turn 40 in June and plans to still play when the NBA returns in October. Next year would be the future Hall of Famer's 21st season in the league. Dirk saying, quote, as of now, I'm planning to come back.
Why not,
I'll
Dirk?
Be back.
Like, why not? He's like...
He's never done.
Like, don't be done as long as they're going to keep paying you. And then, look, every locker room needs one of those guys that's there that can help, like, usher in the new talent and kind of, you know, show them the ropes and teach them how to be a pro. And Dirk's as good a pro as there is. His work ethic is just... It's unmatched. It's unrivaled. His shooting coach, I forget, Holger, you know, I think he's taken some of the younger kids and kind of showed them, you know, different things about their shot. So I think it's a great look. I just, like, Dirk, it feels good now, and then in 6 or 7 years when you stop playing and you roll out of bed, it's just not going to feel the same. That's the only thing I'd say to Dirk.
Yeah, but what's one more year? He's already played like,
I hear you.
Eternity.
I hear
so
you.
What's one more year? He's still going to be sore anyway. Right. So keep rolling, man. It's the most fun gig
Damn,
you've ever had being a professional athlete. So let it keep rolling. All right, let's get in some baseball with our guest David Sampson. He's going to join us right now.
Danny, you have to see this ring that he's rocking.
I've seen it.
You've seen it?
That ring.
Holy
that thing
cow.
Is ginormous. Are you kidding me? That thing is incredible. David, thanks for joining us, man. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Keep in mind, the ring looks much better on guys who aren't 5'5", 127.
I don't know. I would disagree.
Before we dive into some baseball, I've got to talk because I have floated the idea. My wife has actually done a mini triathlon, like the sprint triathlon. I've joked with her saying I could do it, no problem. But these are mini ones. Like, you've done the real deal. You've done 7 marathons on 7 continents in 7 days, like, which is the most insane feat I think I've heard anybody of any athlete out there because of the endurance factor. How did you accomplish it? What went into the preparation, and why on earth would possess you to do that?
Well, let's start with the last question first. What possesses me to do all these things are 2 things. 1, charity. I raise money for charity every time I do one of these events. Back in 2006, when I did the Hawaii Ironman, I was the first ever team president of any sport to do it, and still the only one, which I'm not surprised by. And I was able to raise $250,000 for 2 great charities.
Oh, that's great.
And it took 15 hours and 36 minutes. It was brutal. A year of training. I spent 40 straight Saturdays not going out because you had to wake up Sunday morning to do 100-mile bike rides or swims or 2-a-days. But as they say, the pain is worth it, because once you cross the finish line, you're an Ironman forever. And I have the tattoo to prove it.
So – I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, then I just went on to a double marathon where I raised $600,000 for charity, running 52 miles. And then I said, I got to come up with something else. So I did the World Marathon Challenge, which is the 7 marathons in 7 days on 7 continents. And only 104 people in the world have ever done it. And I raised $1.2 million for charity.
So I know you got Conine in with you on the big one in the Ironman, right? He did did anybody do these marathons with you, or was it you solo?
It was a team, but let me tell you about Conine. Conine did the Ironman after I did because he was so pissed that I did it. Can I say that?
Yeah.
Okay. He was so pissed that he went to Hawaii.
You can say that he was f***ing angry if you want.
Can I? Let me tell you. He reminds me every day, because we're still very close, that he beat me by 52 minutes.
Oh, he's that guy?
He's that guy. And I want to go back so badly and beat him now, except I'm too lazy and I like drinking too much. So I got Conine and 15 other people to do these 7 marathons with me. We formed a team. We had a woman with one leg named Sarah Reinertsen, a very famous Paralympic athlete. We had a man with Parkinson's, become the first ever guy with Parkinson's to do this. So we had 2 people from Survivor, who I was on Survivor with. So we had just a fun group of people. We traveled the world, and we took drugs, and we tried to run 7 marathons.
That sounds like the most insane thing. Like, I'm debating doing, like, 1 marathon. Like,
you
I
should.
Can't even imagine doing what you did.
You just get into a routine. You just have to do 1 marathon, and then you wake up and do another one.
Yeah, my buddy took up Ironmans and marathons, and he started, like, trying to train me. Like, he'll give me the blueprint to train. I'm not built for it. Like, mentally, I think you have to be, like, a mentally tough SOB to, like, get out there and grind like that.
It's 70% mental and 60% physical. Yogi. Thank you.
So I do have some questions about the Marlins. I know you were with them from 2002 until the fall of 2017. What are the emotions when you see the franchise undergoing so much change recently? Like, what emotions do you have?
Well, wow. So just yesterday I was on a therapist's couch talking about that very subject. So I would say the emotions are strong with opening day. It's the first opening day I haven't been a part of in 18 years. And it hurts. I want to be there for the fans. I want to watch a team and have a rooting interest in the team that I love and helped, you know, win a World Series with and lose 100 games and trade players and sign players and have all that conflict. But I think what Derek Jeter's doing now makes sense. It hurts right now. But again, that's the blueprint for success right now in baseball and in the NBA. You're either not going for it or you're going for it. And being in the middle is just the wrong place to be.
Yeah. We're all Florida kids down here, so I remember the championship. I'm a huge baseball fan, but obviously playoff baseball, and when your home team wins, like, that's pretty dope. So in the 2003, right, you got the big shiny ring. What was your favorite memory of that season? Is there anything that sticks out, like, more than the rest?
The number one moment, there's so many moments, but the one story I'll tell is during Game 6 against the Cubs in Chicago. We were losing to Mark Pryor in the eighth inning before that famous eight-run eighth with Steve Bartman. And I was in the clubhouse, and I was preparing my remarks of what I would say to the team. Great run, great season, congratulations. And I was saying it sort of under my breath, but loud enough.
You were rehearsing this.
I was semi-rehearsing, which is strange because I generally have no notes and rehearse nothing. I was just trying to get my thoughts together.
Right, right.
Mike Redmond, who became a future manager who we fired, but at the time he was the backup catcher, he was in the clubhouse getting coffee. And he said, David, shut the f*** up. We're going to win this game.
You're like, what?
And I said, what are you talking about? And I just couldn't believe it. He said, get back to your seat. And this was before we even had a hit off prior as part of that rally. And I remember what happened when we won that game. Mike and I looked at each other and didn't say a word because we still had to win game seven.
Yeah.
We just looked at each other. We knew we had just seen history. And then we knew we'd win game seven. That's wasn't even a question.
That's great.
Up until that, did you feel the slightest bit bad for Bartman?
So remember, we were at the game. So all we saw was a ball that we didn't think could be caught. And then we saw a lot of beer being thrown. And then we saw police. And then we saw chanting. And all we know is Alex Gonzalez had a huge error at shortstop after that. We had a bunch of hits. Dusty Baker had completely mismanaged his starting staff the whole season, including in that series. So we knew we could get to Pryor if we could just hang on. And we knew getting to their bullpen would be fine. And we were confident. I mean, everyone but I at that time. So Bartman was not a focus. Then when we got back to the hotel and watched highlights, we realized that he was being blamed. But there's no way anyone there realized the history that was unfolding and how bad it was going to be.
So a big piece of that team was Josh Beckett. Like he was incredible during that run. Have you seen his mugshot from his arrest this past offseason?
It's my screensaver.
So I actually got to talk to him about it. He said it was a bet, and the guy was like a $75,000 bet that he was supposed to go tackle the guy. And he said the guy actually paid up. So maybe it was worth it for him. 75 for that. That might be not a bad trade-off, right?
$75,000 for a mugshot?
Yeah, I'm in.
I'm out.
You're out?
Out.
75 here's racks for
words,
a mugshot? I'm
here's
taking
the
that.
Words you never want to hear as a public figure. Yeah. Turn to the right.
So look, you touched on the middle ground, right? And you know, the NBA, it's a big conversation now, the tanking. Like, what do you do with that? You imagine that becomes something that baseball has to discuss? Because you're right. Like, if you're in the middle, you're just kind of stuck.
It's happening right now.
Yeah.
The union is very focused on it in baseball because there's so many teams. The whole thing in baseball, going back to Bartlett Giamatti, the old commissioner, and James Earl Jones in Field of Dreams, everyone wants hope during spring. That's what you're hoping for. Hoping for hope. This year, it's not that. There's maybe 10 teams with hope and 20 teams who are saying, hey, let's go to games and have fun and have good in-game entertainment. That's not a good position for a sport to be in.
Right.
I do have another question about the Marlins specifically. So I covered the team for a little bit, and I was there throughout Jose Fernandez and all of that, right? So I saw this team experience so much, and now that this team is completely different and separated – what do you think Marlins fans should do going into the season? Like, what kind of attitude should Marlins fans have? Because for me, I feel like I'm not a fan anymore of the Marlins. Like, I feel like they've lost me now because all of those guys that I was rooting for are gone. And I feel like that energy of the team has completely shifted. And so, yeah, what do you have to say for Marlins fans this season going in?
Just breathe, right? Because be a fan of the name on the front of the uniform, not the name on the back. And be a fan of the process and understand that there was a window that was open and then it closed and now there's another window opening, hopefully. And realize that if it's done right, the way it happened, you know, in Chicago and Houston and Philadelphia 76ers, I mean, there's story upon story of teams who have trusted the process, so to speak. I hate to quote. Is that LeBron?
Yeah, no, Sam Hinkie and Joel Embiid.
Yeah, that's the Sixers.
Yeah, it's all right, though. I mean, it's bearing itself out.
I'm more interested in do than trust, as in DUE, in terms of process, but we can talk about that another time. But I think that as a fan, you just go to a game and enjoy Marlins Park, and there's some fun players to watch. Mm-hmm. Go watch Lewis Brinson hit. He's fun. And, you know, what are you going to do? What's your alternative? To just live in a city where you turn off your team?
Right.
Love your team and love it through good times and bad times. That's called a relationship.
Yeah, that's a great answer.
Yeah, sure. All right, so David's going to be joining us at CBS Sports HQ as an MLB analyst. You've been around the game. You mentioned 18 years with the Marlins. Before that, you were the vice president of the Expos. So you obviously know a lot. You've been paying a lot of attention to Major League Baseball. So let's talk a little about the upcoming season with opening day tomorrow. We just did a segment called Reasonable Expectations. What do you think a reasonable expectation is for Shohei Ohtani?
So I took the under in terms of wins and home runs for him. I think people are thinking he can hit 20 home runs. I don't think he will. People are thinking he can have 15 wins. I don't think he will. I think it's very hard to be a two-way player. Think about it with the NFL. In high school, it's fine. Sometimes even in college back in the day, you could play both sides of the ball or in pony leagues. But in Major League Baseball, it's too hard. To prepare to pitch every 5 days, you have to work in between those days. And to prepare to hit, you have to know who you're facing, unless you're Vladimir Guerrero, who never knew who was pitching against him, see the ball, hit the ball. But you have to know what you're doing. And I think it's too much to ask for a 23-year-old adjusting to the United States from Japan. So I don't even have him as my rookie of the year in the American League. And I certainly wouldn't have had him as the number four man in the rotation going into the season. But I'm sure, and we just talked about it on HQ in a segment just a few minutes ago before I came on with you guys, that they had no choice but to put him in the rotation because I'm sure that was promised to him during the negotiation.
So Aaron Boone, right? New manager, Yankees team that probably exceeded a little bit of expectations last year, but this year they'll be a favorite. Like, what do you think some of the challenges that he'll face being a new manager, and do you see that Yankees team continuing on the trajectory that they were on last year?
So we had Booney with the Marlins. He is a great guy, a very funny guy, a very engaging guy. He will get along well with the players. I don't know his X's and O's and his strategy, but what I do know is what is important for me and a manager is what's the manager like when the team's lost five in a row? Because the Yankees will lose five in a row at one point this year, and they will win five in a row. What is he like during those times? Because players look to that. And how will he deal when Stanton and Judge back-to-back strike out with a man on third in the ninth inning with one out to tie the game, and the Yankees lose that game? How do you deal with those situations? Because it's going to happen. I think the Yankees, I don't think they'll be better than last year in terms of where they finished.
Right.
They came a game away from the World Series. That's hard to do back-to-back years, and I just don't know that they have a pitching staff to do that.
So we like talking stats here on the podcast, and we become increasingly accustomed to them in basketball and football. But when it comes to baseball, we know that it's a stat-driven sport. So what is one relatively obscure stat that you love that we should love too?
Well, are you ready for this?
Oh, I'm so ready.
Brace yourself.
I might have to write this down.
Get ready. I like looking at what the players eat pregame as a leading indicator to how they're going to be during the game.
Nice.
And as opposed to all of the analytics, here's what I don't pay attention to. Hey, did you know this guy is 2-for-6 against this pitcher? We got to get him in the lineup. Do you know that this guy in Minute Maid Field on Wednesday afternoons against a lefty has a very good likelihood, if you throw him a 2-1 changeup, to hit a home run? Right? That's really sweet. But it doesn't. It's very difficult to apply.
So, like, if Justin Bour eats donuts before, is he successful or no?
I love where your head's at. So, the problem with Bour is it's always donuts. So, whether he has a great game or a bad game, but I like to see tradition. I like to see a player and how they get. It's the old time. It's the money ball issue, right? I don't like doing things based on just a piece of paper. I like looking in the players' eyes. I like talking to them. And what are they thinking? How's their life outside the game? How are their relationships? How are their friendships doing? Are they in a fight with their wife or girlfriend? Mm-hmm. Are their kids keeping them up at night? What's happening? Did they run into traffic on the way to the ballpark? Do they have a flat tire? These things, it sounds crazy because in analytics, they don't count.
Right.
But in the real world, when you're up at bat facing a 95-mile-an-hour fastball, having a clear head is way more important than knowing to keep your elbow down, to make sure you're looking the other way. It's hard to think of all those things. Picture a golf swing.
Yeah.
The more complicated you make it, you can't hit it as far.
Yeah. Right.
Just see it and hit it. So I always enjoyed being around the clubhouse, maybe much to the chagrin of some of the guys sometimes, but I didn't do it to be intrusive. I did it just to learn, to understand practices and habits, and then to watch a game after witnessing habits, and then to see what matters.
So what were some of the habits that you witnessed that really stood out to you?
So Ichiro is my number one over 18 years.
Okay.
Ichiro, nothing mattered to Ichiro but the process of getting ready for a game. Whether he was starting or whether he knew he'd pinch hit in the eighth inning, whether he was playing in the field, DHing, whatever he's doing, he had a pregame routine that it was definitely OCD. It borderlined on I assume a psychosis because there's nothing else that you couldn't get him out of that routine no matter what. Rain, shine, he did the same thing every day. And I love that because baseball is such an emotional game. But to be successful, you have to have no emotions.
Right.
So it's impacted my personal life because after 18 years in the sport, I became robotic. And I had this armor over me because there's so many games you can't
be
emotional.
Yeah.
So many at-bats. If you're 0 for 10 or a player is 0 for 15, you can't just say minor leagues. Or if all of a sudden a guy hits a walk-off home run, you don't say give him a contract extension. Mm-hmm. You have to be unemotional about it. And that's Ichiro. He prepared in a totally unemotional way.
Wow.
And he did it the same way every day. And the young players looked at that. He didn't bring his cell phone into the clubhouse. Problem with all these young kids, they're on their phone a lot. And I look to that. That's very distracting. It's why there's no phones allowed in the clubhouse. It used to be they claim it's for gambling. Don't tell anyone.
Yeah.
But it's not.
right.
Wow.
It's the no cell phones. It's such a distraction. And what it causes is 25 guys to not interact.
They're disconnected.
Even like the music, though. Like I remember D. Gordon used to just like blast his music before a game.
So music becomes a thing. Players have headphones a lot now because there were fights in the clubhouse over music. And so each clubhouse has to choose how to solve those fights. The way our clubhouse did it a few different years is there was a playlist of every different kind of music that everyone would like. So the problem is you'd have Barry Manilow followed by some electronic music, followed by a song in Japanese, followed by two songs in Spanish, you know, followed by, you know, AC/DC. Mm-hmm. And so it's very hard to get into a mental groove when that's your playlist because that's so eclectic that it becomes distracting. So I think we lost 90 games that year, and I totally blame it on the playlist. Definitely not on us choosing the players.
Bad playlist, for sure.
That's so crazy.
In the NFL locker room, the weight room was the music spot. Like, everybody wanted music. And so what they did, the solution on most teams I played for was days. Like, you'd have hip-hop day, you'd have country day, you'd have heavy metal day. Like, so they just had themed days. But even still, like, guys would come in there and hate one genre of music, and they'd be ready to throw down. All right, let's keep it rolling with some one-word answers here. All right, so where will Bryce Harper play next?
D.C.
He's going to stay there. So he's going to stay in D.C. All right, what about Manny Machado?
Yankees.
Oh, they're going to back up the truck. All right, World Series picks and winner.
Astros over the Nationals.
Ooh, I like that. Astros going back to back. All right, we're going to lighten it up here towards the end. We're going to have some fun and do some superlatives. All right, so what annoyed you more? Julio the Octopus winning a mascot race or Marlins Man becoming a national phenom?
What, do you live on Google? Holy crap.
You can thank Debo for these, our producer right there.
I mean, Dick Tracy over here came up with some great questions. I'm going to go with Julio winning was very annoying to me.
Wait, I have to ask, like, what is your real opinion on Marlins Man? Unfiltered opinion.
Well, I'm unfiltered to begin with.
Okay.
He is over the top to the point of night sweats.
Hey, you're a movie guy, right?
Yes.
Movie of the year, in your opinion, not Oscars. Movie of the year. Best movie you saw this year. Maybe not even in the Oscar conversation.
It wasn't. I really loved with Channing Tatum and Daniel Craig called Logan.
I wanted Lucky. To see Lucky. That, and I didn't see
really,
it.
Really,
Racetrack
really
robbery.
Good.
Yep. Excellent movie.
Really, really good. Yeah. I also loved Baby Driver.
Yeah.
But I also was emotional about The Shape of Water.
Shape of Water.
You liked Shape of Water.
I didn't see that.
I did. That won the Oscar for Best Picture. I had it picked.
I can't get into the.
Just give it a moment.
All right.
Give it. You have to
Adam
give it time.
Adam Driver, right?
Yes.
Adam Driver and Lucky. Channing Tatum separately can do no wrong. So the fact that they've joined forces and I haven't seen it yet is daunting.
Get on it.
No doubt.
All right. Give us a story from Survivor. Like, what was your most memorable experience on Survivor?
Give me a little backstory. Danny. You didn't get on Survivor, correct? So there may be – I don't want you to get set up here. Danny auditioned for Survivor.
I send in a resume tape and never
heard. So don't set yourself up for something that he's going to – yeah, just back.
Are you telling me, Danny, that you applied and did not get in?
I did not. I like send it to the website. Like whatever.
So did I.
Website, just put it in the mail. No connections, no hookup.
Wait,
my didn't pop.
Hold on.
Can we move his resume forward a little bit now? Do we have the connection?
I was first boot. I've got tons of connections. Danny, so here's the thing. I did the same thing. I just applied online, and I got an interview. I went to L.A. and spent a week, and and I got on. And the number one most difficult part of Survivor was sitting in seat 79J all the way to the Philippines.
Oh, man. That's
no way.
That's fantastic.
I swear to God, it's true.
My back would be thrown out if I did that. I wouldn't be able to walk.
So we had Cliff Robinson on our season. And
Cliff?
Yes, that's Uncle fantastic. Cliffy was on the Braun team. And they moved him up into a bulkhead seat in coach. So he had seat 49K because his legs were so long that there was nothing he could do about it. And the eventual winner my season was a guy named Tony Vlachos, who is a policeman in New Jersey, season 28. He spent the entire 14-hour flight with his head on the tray, wow, leaning down every minute of it. And I'm staring at this guy thinking, oh, I got him. This guy, I got him. Meanwhile, the joke was on me. Yeah.
I'm like so Googling these people as you talk about them. I can't believe that guy won. The heck?
He was good. He was so really good.
I didn't realize that you actually co-wrote and performed in a play. So which MLB storyline this year would lend itself most toward a Broadway or Hollywood script?
Oh, I think you have to go with Stanton and Judge because the expectations are so high on them. And they look like superheroes, so they already look like caricatures. And the question will be, can they possibly live up to the hype? It's going to be super hard to do because people will expect a home run every single at-bat. Yeah. And that's not how Stanton's wired. He is wired to go the other way. When he hits home runs to left field, that's because it just happens. He doesn't try that. So if you go look at his batting practice, I know the Yankees are opening up the ballpark early so people can watch batting practice. He goes the other way for the first two or three rounds every single day in BP because that's when he's feeling good about his stroke. But to me, that's a movie that could be made. I just don't know right now whether it's a tragedy or a comedy.
It's a Bronx Tale, right? We could just go off of that one.
That's very good.
I just saw that, so that's why it was fresh in my mind, even though it really is
I
not
love
funny.
It. All right, David, I will say this. Now that you're a part of our team, hopefully you can develop some of that camaraderie that you had because it is tough. I don't think anybody realizes how tough it is to transition. Like once you've been a part of a team to go to the next kind of career or the next phase – and hopefully we can do that for you here at CBS Sports HQ because I think we've got a pretty good team. Hopefully you'll fit in. And
do you mean Danny, the first time and second time you walked right by me and didn't say hello? Is that the camaraderie you're talking about?
Camaraderie you're talking about?
Because that's really
got him.
I love that.
I did not. I don't know if I didn't see you or I was because sometimes I'm focused. But next time we
sometimes
were hanging out.
You talked to everyone in the pod where I was except me.
Except me. Yeah.
No
just
way.
Let him dodge. Don't let him dodge.
Just
don't,
so
please.
You know.
Accountability.
And by the way, my feelings were hurt zero because I had no higher expectation than that. Because I've always loved your dad more than you. But let's just say that next time, drop a hello and maybe I'll respond.
I apologize for that too. All right.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks for joining us. That was a lot of fun.
Anytime. See you soon. Bye.
All right. Great stuff there from David Sampson. But it's time to finish it up with some topics. What do you got, Debo?
Topics.
It wouldn't be topics. We couldn't go a week without talking about Tom Brady or Gisele Bündchen. Gisele saying that she will not tell Tom Brady, her husband, when to retire. She would just feel too bad about it. He would resent her for it. And ultimately, it's his choice. I mean, she's right there, right?
She's a good wife. That's how you should do it. You should just let him figure it out.
Bro.
And then she'll say, I told you so.
like what she's doing him. Like, why would you tell?
She doesn't need
because
to say
she,
anything.
It's come out before that she kind of has she, wanted Tom Brady to retire in the
up.
Past.
Listen,
she is.
It's
you guys
my
watch
job.
Rocky.
It's
you guys
my
watch
business.
Rocky, right?
You ain't telling me when to retire. Let's get that straight now.
What was the conversation with your wife when you
here's
retired?
Here's why she's doing
my,
this.
My
here's
wife
why
supported
she's doing
me unequivocally with my decision to play basketball. Like it was not her
right.
her job to tell me when it was to retire. Like and my wife, she's got plenty of say in our household. Like, we do that 50-50, but that was my career. So there's no need for her to be telling me when to retire. So, Gisele, hey, thank you for not telling Tom Brady when to retire.
Here's the thing. She's not. She's not backed off at all. You guys saw Rocky, right? So you remember Adrian, how annoying she was telling Rocky to retire, and she'd cry, and she wanted him to retire and all that. She wanted him to quit. That's what Gisele does. And the fact that she came – because I think she finally realized it was kind of annoying that she was telling her husband when to retire. So she's finally woken up and said, you know what? Maybe I should just keep my mouth shut and let him do what he wants to do.
So we're going to keep it short on topics today. This is our final one. And if you go back to kind of our lost tapes, the first ones we released as a podcast, we talked about on a Get to Know segment before Hannah was even involved about if your child was born, if your first child was born, what would you do if you were playing in a championship-type situation? Now, this is not a championship situation.
True.
But Raja's new favorite player, Damian Lillard, will miss tomorrow's Blazers game because of the impending birth of his first child.
You're out, right? It's a no-brainer. I'm out.
Fighting for a playoff spot?
I'm out.
A playoff spot, out. But what if it was a championship?
If it's the NBA Finals, I'm saying, all right, I'll be
Western
there.
Western Conference Finals, yes. Game 7.
Listen, let me tell you what happened to us. Like, when my first son, Dia, was born, we had a doctor that was so dope. My wife hates this lady to this day. If she ever sees her, I don't know what'll happen. But she actually, my wife, it was a false labor type of deal.
Okay.
And so my wife thought her water broke. It didn't break. We went to the hospital. They had her there. The lady knew that we played.
This is first kid?
My first child.
Yeah, first kid jitters too.
The doctor knew that we played the Lakers the next day. And so rather than send her home, they induced. And she went into labor. She had like a labor that was like, I don't know, like 14, 15 hours.
Oh my
And we were there all night. But I was back ready to play the next morning, like I'd shoot around. And all the lady talked about all night was making sure that I had a nice place to sleep and that I was comfortable so that my back would be all right so I could play the next day.
Oh, my God.
My wife hates her. I don't even know her name.
I would agree with your wife on that one. That's a little crazy. I feel like if I was the wife in this situation and my husband was playing in a championship game and I was about to have a baby, I'd be like, you do you, but, like, you owe me forever.
So big. So big.
You owe me so big after this.
I think so many guys like to do it, to be there, because the way it plays out, like, hey, look at me, I'm this big family guy, and they take off during the regular season to be there. You have the rest of your life to be a good husband and a good dad, but you only have a tiny window to be a professional athlete and potentially play in a Super Bowl, play in a playoff game, so any of those. So I think it does matter what the circumstance is, but if it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, when you look at some of the situations that have been talked about, I think you have to maximize that. But to Hannah's point, I think you should absolutely have this discussion while you're dating and know what you're getting into. I remember my wife and I, we actually talked about this while we were dating because it came up with some other athlete. And she was like, no. She's like, you better go. That's your job. Like, that's why you get paid. That's what you get paid to do. She's like, now come back to me as soon as you can. But, you know, we'll be fine.
I'm going to tell another quick story.
And there's nothing you can do. Like, what if something, because everybody else says, what if something goes wrong? What are you going to do? They're probably going to kick you out of the room if something goes wrong, right? Yeah.
More like, so I was invited to shoot in a 3-point shootout. Maybe 07, 08, something like that. I was there. I was in Houston. My wife, she had a miscarriage that year. We were trying to have another child. And so I actually left. I didn't shoot in a 3-point shootout. And I went to be with her. She had DNC and she hates another person in Phoenix. My wife hates a lot of people, apparently. Robert Sarver, because Robert Sarver caught her on a team plane one time and said something to the fact of, like, you should really love your husband. He's a great guy. He left the thing. And my wife was just so insulted. She was like, I was laying there like having a miscarriage and he's my husband. He came home. So Robert Sarver, if you ever see Cindy Bell somewhere, duck, brother.
That's amazing.
He did pay you.
I love it.
Huh?
He did pay you, right?
Who paid me?
Robert Sarver.
For what?
For playing for the Suns.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we're straight. We're straight. Rob, I've told that story too, right? About the, I have, yes. Anyway, Rob's an interesting dude. I love his fam though.
All right, that's a wrap for today's podcast. Make sure you go check us out on Apple Podcasts, subscribe, download, anywhere you can find podcasts. We're basically out there, Google Play, Stitcher, SoundCloud. Leave us that 5-star review. This Friday, we're going to do another edition of our 5-star Q&A where you ask us anything you want and we'll get to it. And as always, leave us some feedback at Kinnell and Bell on Twitter and Instagram. Have a great day.